Thank you very much, Marco. Thank you as well. Thanks to our hosts here in the House of Europe, and of course, thanks to all of you for coming here today. As has been mentioned, the summit begins tomorrow, and many people in Europe have the feeling that the European drama that has been unfolding over the past years may be about to reach its climax. We're surrounded by breathless journalists, we're surrounded by clueless observers, by sleepless policymakers. And I think it's fair to say that if we follow media reporting these days, then short-term thinking rules. We're always thinking until the next morning the market's open, what's going to happen to Italian bond spread, Spanish government debt. So I think before we plunge into these 72 hours of drama, this is a good moment to pause for some reflection. Let's take this moment of the quiet before the storm to take a step back and to ask ourselves, what is really at stake here in this crisis? And more importantly, if we're thinking about the different scenarios, the different outcomes that this crisis may have, what would really be a good yardstick for a solution that comes out of it? As we put the different proposals that are on the table next to each other, how should we evaluate them? What is a desirable outcome of the crisis? To my mind, this yardstick for an evaluation of any sensible solution to this crisis has actually two important components. When I cycle to my work in the morning at the University of Amsterdam, I pass a fairly new monument just next to the municipal building of Amsterdam. There is a monument of Spinoza, Baruch Spinoza, the philosopher. Very nice monument. And at the bottom is engraved one of the more well-known quotes from Spinoza. The goal of the state is freedom. The goal of the state is freedom. Now that is a statement that is, good Amsterdam tradition, open to a wide variety of interpretations. But when I hear the goal of the state is freedom, then I interpret it in a way that is in many ways inspired by Amartya Sen. Namely, that freedom means putting people in control of their own lives and their own destiny. That is freedom. And what that then means is that the goal of the state is to help people to become individually and collectively more in control of their lives and their own fates. The realization that is in this quote is that collectively, acting together, we have something to win when we think about this kind of freedom. It's not only about individual freedom, it's about a collective freedom. So I say the first yardstick is, I want an order to emerge from this crisis that puts more than is the case now, the European people in charge of their own life. The second yardstick is something that you could call sustainability. Now, most people, when they hear sustainability, they think of ecological sustainability. They think of climate change. They think of recyclable plastic bottles, these sorts of things. And that's not at all what I mean. Sustainability means that acquiring, enjoying something today does not undermine your ability to acquire or enjoy the same thing tomorrow. It means that realizing prosperity, welfare today is not dependent on something that, by the same token, undermines that same welfare tomorrow. So if you put these two together, you could say the yardstick is, I want a European order to emerge from this crisis that puts people in charge, that also puts their children in charge, or it doesn't undermine the capacity of Europe's children, a generation hence, to be in charge of their own fate as much as will be the case today. So put these together and you say you want a social and political order to emerge from this, in which the European people have a stake, there's something in it for them, and they have a voice as well. I'm sure you hear me talking and think, well, it's all nice and fine, but what on earth does that have to do with the Europe? Well, mind you, there is a very direct link. Because if the way that financial markets have evolved over these past years has taught us something, then it is that while financial markets have the capacity to equip us with welfare, put us in charge of our own lives, can also be an enormously constraining force. We've seen people protesting in the streets of Athens, of Rome, of Madrid, of Lisbon. Maybe 2 years from now, we'll see them here on the Mali and the Hague. Financial crisis has constrained individuals in many ways. Securities have been taken away. People have lost their homes, their jobs. They have been forced to rearrange their working lives in ways that they had never asked for. Pensions have evaporated. All these are constraints that take away people's liberty to be in charge of their own lives. And it's a direct outcome of the way that we have run financial markets before the crisis, and how they have evolved over these past years. So what the crisis has made clear is that we, people in the Netherlands, people in Europe, and indeed people across the OECD world, the industrialized countries, have become in many ways very dependent on these elusive financial markets, that they have started to guide our choices and our lives in many ways. If you want to use a very simple and evocative phrase, we realize these days that European societies, among others, have become addicted to credit. And as much as we would like to sever that link between our economy and this infusion, constant infusion of credit into them, we find that actually we can't really sever that link. We're still dependent on the financial sector to inject credit into our economy. We're still dependent on the financial sector to provide debt to government. And that is an enormous constraint on the European people to give shape to Europe and their own politics. Now, as was mentioned before, what we may be facing in the weeks and months to come is potentially the biggest overhaul of the architecture of Europe that we've seen since the 1950s. And that's no mean thing. Unfortunately, the decisions that are being taken right now and will be taken in the days to come are being taken with financial markets breathing down politicians. In that sense, that is quite the opposite of the ideal of deliberation that you would want for the momentous decisions that are about to be made. Politicians will anxiously wake up on Monday morning. They will be reading the charts of stock markets, of bond markets, to see whether the solution that they have come up with is well received or maybe spells doom for you. Having said that, there are still things that can go wrong this coming weekend and things that can go right this coming weekend. And so if we do not only want quick fixes, but actually a sustainable solution to the predicaments within which Europe finds itself these days, we have to ask, which requirements, tangible, concrete terms, would an order that emerges from this crisis have to fulfill to deserve our approval? That is what I want to talk to you about in the remaining 30 minutes. And I'll do, though, by going through three facets of the sustainable order that I've talked about. Financial sustainability, economic sustainability, and political sustainability. Let's start with the short term. That's maybe the easiest one. It's become very clear that markets these days are out of kilter. What has been happening in government debt markets, for example, no longer corresponds in any meaningful way to the fundamental strength of the European economy. All the factories that we need to provide ourselves with the material welfare that we are enjoying these days, they're all still in place. Europe is as capable today of providing its own people with that material wealth as it was 2 years ago. That's all still there. So as far as that is concerned, I think it's quite fair to ask governments, to public authorities, to step in quite forcefully in this crisis and put an end to what has been a spiraling out of control, if you will, financial market. The European Central Bank, never mind protestations from Berlin that this is going to spell doom, needs to intervene in financial markets to put an end. And I have confidence that if a sensible and meaningful agreement on some kind of fiscal pact is going to emerge this coming weekend at the European summit, that then the European Central Bank will do its bit to calm down the market. The other bit that is talked about quite a lot has to do with putting financial markets themselves at work, financial regulation, which is actually my own home territory. And indeed, if you look at the different proposals that have been made, and some of them have already been implemented, there are quite a few sensible thoughts among them. Bigger bank buffers that protect them against losses and insolvency. Curbs on excessive bonuses that have provided incentives to people working in the financial sector, CEOs and traders alike, to take excessive risks, knowing that should losses occur, those can be put on the backs of. Maybe getting some grip on credit rating agencies. These days, again, much in the news, in light of the announcement that potentially even the strongest of the European economists are up for a downgrade by Standard & Poor's and Moody's. But truth be told, these kinds of measures are the old-style regulation that we had before the crisis, but then just a little bit tightened up. And I think we need more. I think we actually need a new philosophy in financial regulation if we want a sustainable financial system. What this crisis has shown us is that financial markets, if they're let loose, tend to dig their own grave. Now, that is something that, to be fair, we can't afford. There is something in financial markets that John Maynard Keynes, among others, was very keenly aware of and that we've rediscovered that you could call reflexivity. And I think it's an important concept to get into. What does financial market reflexivity mean? It means that what investors, credit rating agencies, what market actors do, they don't only observe what is happening and they don't only form their assessments of what the future might hold, but by this very assessment, they shape the future. If the players on bond market, on stock market, think that everything is going to be great, they'll put all their money into, whether it's Greek government debt, particular corporations, say Philips, then that act in itself, coming out of the positive expectation, will, for example, provide the Greek government temporarily with the means to continue on a path toward economic growth. If the expectation is negative and all these funds are withdrawn, then as in a self-fulfilling prophecy, Greek or a corporation like Philips will see its own demise. Financial markets don't only assess the future, they shape the future. In that sense, they're reflective. Now, that gives rise to both upward and downward spiral. There is no anchor that somehow ties what financial markets do to sort of felt internal equilibrium. They can spiral both ways. Way too far upward, and as we're experiencing now, way too far down. Now, what that means in a nutshell is that the provision of debt, whether household debt, corporate debt, government debt to an economy, begets the creation of yet more debt. Because you infuse debt, economy does great, and you have the feeling that providing debt to an economy, there's nothing wrong with that. And so you give more. Just like we've seen here in Dutch housing market. Provide a lot of mortgages, housing prices go up, nobody defaults, and yet more credit is provided. Until also Dutch housing markets have spun totally out of control. So debt makes even more debt look sustainable, even though ultimately that cannot be the case and we find ourselves in a massive pond. Now, if you put the creation of credit in the hand of a financial sector that earns its money with creating more credit, that is more debt, then you're in store for trouble. So limiting the supply of credit somehow, putting ties on the urge of financial market players to provide credit to whoever can take it is a sensible idea. And it's something that is actually starting to be discussed. But it's not enough. Why? Because there is not only an excessive supply of credit in the European economies, there's also an excessive demand. And getting this demand right is something that ties to the second theme, namely what I would call finding economic sustainability for Europe. I mentioned John Maynard Keynes earlier. John Maynard Keynes had, as one of its key insights, that the demand side of the economy is crucial. If you want economic growth, you somehow have to make sure that there are people and corporations around who have the money in the pockets to buy the stuff that comes out of our factory. And if the most competitive producers, there's nobody to buy the things they make, and you won't have economic growth. Now, the nasty thing he found was that the rich in a society have the irritating habit to save more than they earn. And money disappears from the circle of role, money in the economy. So where does that extra demand come from that buys the things that the rich won't buy because they have enough money and just put it in a savings account? For some countries, the answer has been to sell it to other countries, to export. Is that going to be a sustainable model for Europe? Well, no. In the global pyramid of development, countries like those of the European Union stand at the very top. And it's actually those further down, the China, the Indias of this world that are trying to climb the ladder of economic development by exporting to us products that are manufactured with cheap labor. The idea that Europe could get back on a sustainable path towards economic growth by having a constant export surplus with the rest of the world, now that the US, as the consumer of last resort, is imploding, is ridiculous. That is not going to be the answer. Of course, we've tried other options in history. One would be simply to print money. 1920s, my own home country in Germany, that has had completely devastating effects, but also in other places in the world, simply starting the printing press as a way to try to keep economic growth up is surely unsustainable. It leads to inflation and ultimately often economic devastation. Printing money is also not an option. Once the post-war reconstruction boom was over, we tried yet another thing, government borrowing. Led into the 1970s, at stagflation, governments finding that they had to borrow ever more money, not only to keep economies afloat, but also to be able to repay yesterday's debt. Clearly unsustainable. Now that has, in the 1980s, led to yet another version of trying to keep economies afloat through credit. Namely, not having governments borrow the money, but having private individuals, households, corporations borrow. Some people in my profession, political economy, have called that privatized changing. So it's still debt providing the demand for what's being produced, but it's not public debt, it's private debt. Now, where that leads is something that you have been able to witness. U.S. real estate markets. Remember 4 years back, we were talking about the subprime crisis, which was a real estate sector that is ultimately unproductive, used as an ATM to finance economic growth. Clearly unsustainable. So the question then is, what could actually be a sustainable source of demand for the European economies that does not rely on the constant buildup of debt somewhere, with corporations, with households, or with governments? See people starting to wonder, okay, so what is the golden bullet? It's not something that is very popular still, because the only thing that I see as a sustainable answer to that question is a redistribution that is financed through taxes. Not popular, I'll tell you right away. But having gone through all the other options, I do not see where European growth could come from if it wasn't for taking money that is simply sitting somewhere in bank and wealth that is stocked up elsewhere and that is not being used, that does not have the fact of stimulating economic growth. What that means is that we would have to address, through forms of redistribution, three imbalances that have built up in the European economy over the past, say, 20 years. The first one is social inequality. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, the Rich Countries Club, came out with a report a few days ago on inequality in OECD society between rich and poor. And even though the OECD had always been brandished as a bastion of neoliberal thinking, here it came with a report that rang the alarm bells on the rising gap between rich and poor all over the OECD world. And the OECD, again, this bastion of putatively neoliberal thinking, urged governments to address these growing social inequalities, not because of some clemency, some act of charity, because it understood itself that sustainable growth needs a balance between different strata of society, not only to keep the social peace, but also to keep economic growth on a sustainable level. Make a similar kind of argument about imbalances that have grown not within countries, but actually between countries in the European Union. The Germans, the Dutch, the Finns have thrived with their economic growth over the trade deficits at the southern periphery of Europe. Germany's economic fortunes were directly tied to Portugal's, Italy's, to Greece's economic misfortune. That was financed by debt. The buildup of government debt, Portuguese case more the buildup of private debt, same in Ireland, clearly unsustainable. So whether you like it or not, if you want to keep the European economic order open to trade across the continent, and you want to do that without an excessive buildup of debt somewhere, then you will need to find a way to channel demand from where the accumulation of wealth is happening now, northern European countries, countries like the Netherlands, to countries elsewhere. Again, I do not say that because I think that we should feel sorry for the Greeks. Maybe we should, but that's not the point. The point is what will be a sustainable model on which economic Europe can thrive. Of course, alternatives stand in the room. The breakup of the euro, for example. And maybe if we go back to the mid-1990s, we come to the conclusion that the arguments in favor of introducing a single currency were slightly overblown, and the warnings against the downsides of a single currency were not properly heeded. I think that that's probably correct. That does not mean, to my mind, that we could simply turn back the clock, pretend it was 1995, and choose a different composition of the Eurozone that only comprises the Austrians, the Germans, the Dutch, and so on and so forth. As of 2011, the Dutch economy, as all the other economies within the Eurozone, have completely adjusted to the presence of a single currency and an open trading order. Turning back that clock would come with massive adjustment costs. We're not in 95, and we cannot make that decision over again. The costs, again, would be enormous. What that means, then, is that the only choice that we really have, to my mind, is more integration of some sort. Now, that, of course, is something that with many European citizens these days is not exactly popular. Germans, for right or wrong, think that their prosperity is about to be taken away. The Greek are loath to cede on a permanent basis yet more power to Brussels, which they see as the source of all the evil that has descended on the Greek society. So the question arises then, how could we achieve more European integration in a way that is also politically sustainable, the third pillar of the sustainability that I'm talking about? Political sustainability of a more integrated European order needs to combine two things. A European institutional arrangement that is effective in getting things done, but that also enjoys the kind of legitimacy that you talked about earlier, that enjoys the support of the European people. Now, we know that different facets of economic policy interact quite strongly with each other. Monetary policy, fiscal policy, taxation policy, financial market regulation, and different programs of spending, whether that's structural funds, regional funds, welfare spending, now still mostly at the national level. What that means is that if we want to integrate these different functions that are inevitably interdependent, then we will need a strong set of European institutions, and one of these pillars will have to be an executive in the form of a European Commission, of one sort or another, assuming many of the powers that are necessary to coordinate these kinds of policies well. But that's, of course, only one. That's getting some kind of real power. Get things done. The other one is the legitimacy. So what kind of representation then would actually put people, the European citizens, in charge and in control of this machinery that would emerge in Brussels? The European Parliament, to my mind, is the only institution capable of doing it. It's the only credible source on checks and balances on the different institutions that we have on the European level. As I mentioned before, these days, this kind of pro-integration thinking is not exactly popular with European citizens. But once you start thinking about it in terms of what is going to put European citizens more in the driving seat? National parliaments clawing back power to themselves or giving it to the European Parliament? Then I think if European citizens want more control of their own lives, more control of the economic and political circumstances in Europe, then the European Parliament, with all the imperfections that it may have, will be more of an answer to gain control over your own societal life than national parliaments are likely to be. So European countries this coming weekend will have to choose. Because EU light, what we've had so far, integration light, no longer is an option. Sustainable order will have to mean a refusal to keep muddling through at some point and actually make the tough choices. I hope, personally, that the European leaders will get their act together, if you will, and craft a political order that is capable of being legitimate and making those tough choices. Whether that happens is, of course, an open question. I started early in my talk by saying that when I cycle to university in the morning, I pass Pinot. And I'll do the same tomorrow morning. When I cycle by and the European summit is about to start, then I'll ask myself, will the European leaders assembled in Brussels be able to craft a political order that is going to be financially sustainable, that will put Europe on a path towards sustainable economic growth, and that will at least take the first steps towards installing a political order in Europe that is both effective and legitimate? Because these three things, if you want them to be sustainable, can only be had together. But I think if they manage to do that, at least take the first meaningful step in that direction, then I think they will actually have served citizens in the way that I interpret Spinoza and what it says there on his monument. Because they will have delivered European citizens into a new economic and political order in which these same European citizens can be architects of their own European fortune, both individually and collectively. Thank you very much.